good morning and welcome again to another edition of One Land, Many Voices. I'm one of your hosts, Will Seaman, and who's with me in the studio this morning?
This is Hala Goris. Good morning, Will, and good morning to our listeners. And I have to say, this is an absolutely gorgeous, sunny October morning.
It's a little chilly outside.
I don't mind chilly as long as we have sunshine.
It's warm in here, and we have a wonderful show. Mention first that introduction was not our normal introduction music. Who are we listening to this morning?
We're listening to Marcel Khalife, who is the UNESCO Artist for Peace. We are delighted and lucky to have Marcel Khalife in town Sunday night. He will be playing at the Baghdad Theater, and he is, I just pronounced that in Arabic.
Actually, that's not the Aladdin?
I'm sorry, I apologize.
That's
I'm glad you're here with me. So for all of our listeners, go to the Aladdin Theater, please, or in Arabic, Alaeddin, but it is the Aladdin Theater, Sunday, October 28th. That's this coming Sunday at 7:30. The doors will open at 6:30, and we have tickets to sell. For anyone who wants to come to the Marcel Khalife concert, Sunday, October 28th, this Sunday at 7:30 at the Aladdin Theater, please call me at 503-295-1940, 503-295-1940. Tickets are $25 each or $35. So we hope to hear from you.
And I want to make just one more announcement before we get to our very special guest. I'm going to keep you in suspense about who that guest is. But I want to mention a very important documentary film that's showing at the Hollywood Theater, and that is a documentary called Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People. That's showing Saturday, November 3rd at 1:30 p.m. at Hollywood Theater, and that's at 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Again, that's a documentary. If you probably heard about it earlier on Democracy Now! They did a feature about this very important documentary. It's called Real Bad Arabs. Real is spelled, incidentally, R-E-E-L. How Hollywood Vilifies a People, showing Saturday, November 3rd here in Portland at the Hollywood Theater at 1:30 in the afternoon. Now, we have this morning a very special guest, someone who I think doesn't do nearly enough interviews like this, but was kind enough to join us this morning, Milton Viorst, who has covered the Middle East as a journalist and scholar since the 1960s. He's a former Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker, for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times. He's written for The Wall Street Journal. He's author of many, many books on the Middle East, including Storm from the East, The Struggle Between the Arab World and the Christian West. What Do I Do with These People, Jews and the Fractious Politics of Judaism, Sands of Sorrow, Fundamentalisms and the Conflicts in the Middle East, and In the Shadow of the Prophet, The Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Mr. Milton Viorst, thank you for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices.
Nice to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, there are, of course, many topics we could be discussing with you this morning, but in particular, we're going to be talking about a recent review you published called On the Israel Lobby, the book recently released by Stephen Walton and John Mearsheimer. Stephen Walton and John Mearsheimer were here in Portland only two nights ago, brought to Portland by the World Affairs Council, speaking to a packed hall over at the Hilton Hotel here in downtown Portland. Now, we've only grazed this topic in some of our previous programs, but we're going to dive headlong into this very controversial topic. And I'm certain, even though this is maybe the first time we've dealt with it, it won't be the last. Mr. Viorst, if we could start, as you do in your review article, with your own experiences, with the challenges you've faced when writing critically about the policies of Israel.
Well, it sounds a little bit like whining, so I don't like to talk about it a lot, but I have had problems with not only getting published, but once I've been published with the response to it, I've often had problems with going on television where I have said things and have been the recipient of a huge amount of clearly inspired email. So you know, the Jewish lobby or the Israeli lobby, call it what you like, is very well organized and has a strong sense of itself. And listen, we can admire that. That's the political system we live in. But it has really significantly limited debate on American policy in the Middle East. And Mearsheimer and Wald have really ignited something, because clearly the American people are beginning to sense that that may be true. And as you point out, they received a huge response in Portland, but they have also received a comparable response around the country. So perhaps this is changing, changing in the sense that this subject will no longer be taboo, because I think it is not in the interest of American Jews, it's not in the interest of Israel, for these issues not to be discussed.
Mr. Viorst, good morning. This is Hala Goris.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. We're so happy to have you here. You know, when we attended this lecture by Mearsheimer and Wald, they made it very clear that this was not a Jewish lobby, that this is a lobby comprised of some Jewish groups, but certainly the Christian Zionists, for instance, other organizations that benefit by and corporations that benefit by what Israel is doing. I don't think they specifically discussed it, but for instance, corporations that benefit by from the war machinery. So I want to get your view about whether we need to be careful calling it a Jewish lobby. From my perspective as a Palestinian American, saying anything negative and connecting it to the word Jewish or Jews has had a totally chilling effect on our voicing of opinions because of the threat of being called anti-Semitic.
Well, Hala, you raise an interesting point and an important one, and maybe it's a little bit semantical than real. Yes, there is what I would call an alliance of lobbies. I don't have any problem with calling it a Jewish lobby, because I'm Jewish myself, and the organizations that I think in terms of represent the Jewish community in the United States. One of the things I argued in my review that you cited earlier is that what Mearsheimer and Wald called the Israeli lobby ought to be called the right-wing Israeli lobby, because there are many Jews in the United States who are profoundly troubled by the positions. And I think this is true with an increasing number of Jews. Now, unfortunately, the left-wing or the peacenik Jewish lobby, or again, once again, it's a semantic issue, call it what you like, are small. They tend to be poorer. They don't have the money for huge organizations or for great ads in the New York Times or the Washington Post, but they're out there, and I think they are an increasing number, and I would like to think they are getting stronger, although I have to confess that the evidence for that is a little thin.
You know, let's not assume that all of our listeners know about how this controversy about the book itself, the Israel Lobby, got started. Would you mind telling us about how this discussion of the Israel Lobby got started back in 2006 with the publication of the Walt Mearsheimer article in the London Review of Books?
Well, it didn't surprise me, but let me, again, since you invited me to say something about
sure.
my own experience, 30 years ago, I received a letter from Abe Foxman, who is the leader of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, who said, we Jews should not be washing our dirty linen in public. And this is a perfectly legitimate statement if there was a voice where these things could be argued in private. My problem with the Jewish lobby and the Jewish community is that it is very difficult to get very, very important issues about the future of the Jewish people debated at all. I wrote a book called What Shall I Do With This People, which is a statement that Moses makes to God when he in the Old Testament, in Exodus, and where he is having such terrible problems with this this headstrong, stiff-necked people, the Jews. Well, we are headstrong and stiff-necked, and maybe I'm one of them too. But the fact is, what I have been trying to do is open this debate to another point of view, because I think it's in Israel's interest and the interest of the Jews around the world and in the Jewish community worldwide. So the Jewish lobby was pretty successful in keeping this debate stifled. And then lo and behold, these two guys who they had never heard of, Mearsheimer and Walt, appeared one day in the London Review of Books, saying things which probably everybody knew. I don't think there was anything terribly surprising about what they wrote, but what was surprising is that it was published at all. Now, it's interesting that it was published in London. It wasn't published in the United States. They did have problems getting a publisher, but they did. And I think that the Israel lobby, the Jewish lobby slash Jewish lobby, made a rather significant error in overreacting. My guess is that had they ignored Mearsheimer and Walt, we would never heard another word from them again. But instead, they rose up in great indignation and saying, "How dare you say these things?" Which were sort of banal and commonplace, really, which everybody in Washington knows about the Jewish lobby. But by making such a fuss of it, they made rather glittering personages of Walt and Mearsheimer, and so they were invited to put their work into a book, which is the book that we are now discussing today, called The Israel Lobby. And again, because of this sensitivity, I think they have turned it into a bestseller. I think the Israel Lobby. Has turned it into a bestseller. It probably would have dropped down along with millions of other public affairs books that are published over the years. But this one has gotten everybody's attention, not because it's such a wonderful book or says something that nobody knows, but because it has created such a controversy.
That's fascinating in light of Jimmy Carter's book. Don't believe it would have had certainly the number of sales. It would have been a bestseller, but certainly not to this level.
I don't think it would have been even a bestseller.
Now, be kind to Jimmy Carter.
No, I am. He's wonderful. I love Jimmy Carter, and he's been very kind to me. And he has, you know, I could not admire an American any more than I admire him. But let's face it. The word apartheid was in it, which is what really drove so many Jews up the wall, although the word is frequently used very critically in among Israelis and in the Israeli press, but it was more Jimmy Carter writing off the top of his head. Unfortunately, Jimmy Carter did not do a lot of clear research or a lot of little mistakes in that book, which were quite unnecessary. If he had been more careful, or if he had had a more careful reader, he would have been able to hold off some of the criticism. But the fact is, clearly, and it surprised me, the American people have been waiting for a book of this sort, and then Mearsheimer and Walt come along on Jimmy Carter's heels, and suddenly things are being said now that haven't been said for decades.
And I want to remind our listeners, they're tuned to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO this morning, and we'd like to invite you, our listeners, to take part in this conversation. As always, One Land, Many Voices prides itself on calm and, respectful discussion, so I'd like our callers to keep that in mind. This is a topic that does evoke a number of emotions, not all of them particularly positive. You can call at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. If you'd like to take part in our discussion this morning, please be patient if we do keep you on hold for a while, because, of course, Hala and I have plenty of questions for our guest, who is, again, Milton Viorst, who has been writing about the Middle East. He's been a journalist and scholar since the 60s, and we're talking this morning about the Israel lobby. That book recently out by Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer. I'd like to go back a little bit to this question of the role of Abraham Foxman, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, because you write in your article as well some commentary by, I think it's Irving Howe, about the vested interest that leaders of these different organizations have in terms of essentially encouraging the perception of widespread anti-Semitism here in the United States. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that element of this controversy.
Well, there are two different things. Irving Howe talked about not so much anti-Semitism, although that may be a consequence of this, or the accusation of anti-Semitism, but the whole bureaucracy of the Jewish establishment, and particularly the Israel lobby, thrives on the notion that Israel is in danger. We've seen this before with other lobbies. I mean, that's one of the techniques they are comfortable with for not only promoting their own positions and for their own self-esteem, making themselves feel important because they are defenders of whatever cause that they may be involved with, but also their very jobs depend upon it. If you can't really have a very effective lobby unless you can convince your constituents that your cause is in jeopardy. And of course, Irving Howe, who was a very, very wise man, understood that. And so I did cite it, and I think it's very important because I think that's one of the factors we have. I mean, I get letters, and maybe my Jewish listeners must also get them too, from organizations like the American Jewish Committee, which say, anti-Semitism has never been worse. Israel has never been in greater danger. We are really on the edge of a resumption of the Holocaust. I mean, all kinds of things you can't believe that come in the fundraising letters. And needless to say, it's a trick, it's a device that all lobbies use, and the Jewish lobby or the Israel lobby is not immune to it.
Mr. Viorst, we have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I mean, I get letters. Is that me?
It is you.
I understand that the Israelis have offered $60,000 to members of the Jewish community in Tehran if they would settle in the West Bank, enlarge the settlements that Israel has established there to drive the Arabs out of that area. And that they were turned down because the Iranian Jewish community felt that they didn't want to be any part of this bellicose present leadership in Israel. Do you have a comment on that? And incidentally, how is it that Americans who feel that there hasn't been the willingness on the part of Israel to have an equitable solution with the Palestinians regarding a division of that precious land to both people? How can
well,
we...
Well, you've asked two big questions. The first of which, and I'm not sure, I have never heard this fact about the $60,000 being offered to members of the Iranian Jewish community, but let me say it is not inconsistent with the policy of Zionism and the Israeli government since the very beginnings of the movement, and particularly since the very beginnings of the state. The state of Israel exists as a shelter for Jews, and it has been quite successful in terms of creating a homeland where Jews who regard themselves as being in trouble in the lands of their births can come. And so Israel, which started in very large measure as a refuge for the victims of Nazism in Europe, has also over the years attracted Jews from throughout the world who feel they will be more comfortable in an atmosphere there where hostility is not going to be something they will experience. And I think one of the unforeseen consequences of the Zionist movement is that virtually all of the Jews who lived since biblical times in the Arab world have come to Israel. There are very few who have remained. The Iranian community is perhaps the last of the great communities in the Islamic world, and it's I think its members are gradually migrating, although it must be said, not just to Israel, but to the United States. So, you know, there has been a huge demographic transformation. I should also add, and I think this is important to note, that many, many Christian communities have also been depopulated because there are many Christian communities in the Muslim world over the course of the century since biblical times, and the numbers keep dropping for much the same reason. The whole Islamic extremism has driven a lot of these people out. So one of the sad results, or maybe it's not so sad, but one of the consequences is that both the Christian and Jewish communities that were a very important part of the Islamic world over the course of all of the centuries since biblical times are in our own time increasingly fewer numbers, some of them to the point of non-existence.
Mr. Viorst, I'd like you to get to the second part of the caller's question, but may I test what you had just stated?
Go ahead.
My family goes back several hundred years, as far as we could tell based on the Ottoman census, goes back several hundred years in Palestine. They are Christian Palestinians, and I can recall, and this is obviously anecdotal in terms of information we get, I can recall my own grandparents talking about the good relations they had with Muslims in various villages and going into Syria. And so I get concerned when information is out there that Christian Arabs are leaving because of Muslim extremism. I'll use Palestinians as an example. The majority of Palestinians I know, my family members know, in the hundreds, Christian Palestinians leaving Israel and leaving the West Bank due to Israeli policies, not due to bad relations with Muslim neighbors, with fellow Palestinian Muslims. So it's Israeli apartheid that drove us out.
Well, let it be said that there is never a single cause for the great historical movements. This is one of the arguments I always make when, and one of the criticisms I have of the Mearsheimer Walt book, who say the Israeli lobby is responsible for this or that. I learned a lesson when I was an undergraduate when I had a very wise professor who gave a lecture on the causes of the Civil War, and we as undergraduates who were 16 or 17 or 18 years old then always thought, well, it's slavery or it's this or it's that, but it's all of the above playing into this. And the fact is, I think that one of the reasons is the Israeli oppression, but one of the reasons also is Islamic extremism. This is certainly true in Lebanon, Hala. It's certainly true in Iraq. So I think neither one of us has to be right or wrong on this one. I think we should not blame it all on the Israelis.
I want to remind folks that we are taking calls this morning for our guest, Milton Viorst. You can call at 503-231-8187. If you do get through to us, please be patient, and please turn down your radio as well. We'd really appreciate it. It's a lot easier not to get distracted if we can't hear a conversation 3 seconds behind us of what we've just said coming through your phone line. It looks like we do have a caller in the line. Yes, caller, your question for Milton Viorst. Caller, are you there?
Looks like we lost our caller.
Well, I have another question. I know that just as you mentioned, Mr. Viorst, that there are a number of issues that you disagree with in terms of the thesis by Walton Mearsheimer about the Israel lobby. But I wonder, what areas do you think they get it right? What are the areas that, as you read through their book or their article, were you especially pleased to see coming out in such a public way?
Well, I think that they have raised the sensitivity of Americans, and I think this is helpful. And again, I argue that this is helpful for Jews and Israel to understand this, both of a certain amount of disproportionate power of the Israeli lobby. Let us understand that Washington functions, as most political system functions, in very large measure, not just in terms of big numbers, but also in terms of intensity of conviction. You say, why is the gun lobby so important? The gun lobby is important because the people who represent the constituency of the gun lobby are very, very deeply committed to their feelings. So that if you get a poll which says, and this happens all the time, let's say it happens in Israel, are you in favor of returning the settlements if we can acquire a peace agreement with the Palestinians? And you get consistently 60 or 70% of people who are willing to make that trade. But the fact is that the settlers are so much more committed to their cause than Israelis generally, that they have a disproportionate amount of power. And that's one of the factors that makes the Israel lobby so important, because the Jews in America are so deeply committed to Israel. So I think this is something that we have to keep in mind. I regard myself as extremely committed to Israel, except I feel that the course that Israel is following is ultimately self-destructive, that it is in Israel's interest not to dominate its neighbors, but to make peace with them. And so we have a different perception of what's in Israel's interest.
You know, what troubles me about that statement is that you're focusing on just what is good for Israel, instead of that it is morally repugnant to watch what Israel is doing, or to, I understand completely that you do not support what Israel is doing in the occupied territories. I'm just a bit troubled by the complete focus on what is good for Israel, instead of focusing on that it is morally wrong. The policies in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem are morally wrong.
Well, this program to which you have been kind enough to invite me is on the subject of the Israel lobby, and I am speaking from that narrow focus. Are you saying that I am a person who has no other interest in the concerns of the universe? I think that would be a little bit unfair, Hala, but the fact is that as long as you have narrowed the scope of our conversation, I am talking within those terms.
And I can appreciate that. We do have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, hello. I want to thank you all for your courage and your mental health for having this program and talking about these things that are uncomfortable and probably painful. But I want to raise some consciousness or say something. I've been hearing through the years off and on the radio and TV, on lectures or at colleges, whatever, places, people who get to talk saying things like, everybody knows. You know what the reality is? A lot of people don't know what you're talking about or don't want to know. And we need to hear you and other people, because we're not going to hear it or read it any other place. So I must have heard it on this program too. Everybody knows. But anyway, whether or not, I just want to raise that consciousness to the people like yourselves that are privileged to do this important, uncomfortable work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you for the call. Well, let's turn then to some of the concerns that you raised, some of the disagreements that you have with Mr. Walt and Mr. Mearsheimer. In particular, I think one of the more controversial, I would suggest is very likely the most contentious claim that they make, is the prominence of the role played by the Israel lobby in terms of driving the United States to war in Iraq. And I wonder if you could talk specifically about that question, and then we can turn to some other elements of their work.
Yeah, let me precede the direct answer to that question by saying, like you and Hala or anybody else, it is very rare that you pick up and read through a rather voluminous, a huge, fat, heavy work of history like this and agree with every word. But that doesn't, I mean, you are a discerning reader, and I regard myself as a reasonably discerning reader, and so it should not be surprising if in this 500-page or 400-page book, I don't remember exactly how many they are. It's sitting here on my desk, and I could look it up if you like. But
it's a big book.
Yeah, it's a big book. It's a fat book, and it's heavy. And it should not surprise you if there are things that you disagree with. That's true whether you are writing about Alexander the Great or your subject was the Japanese Empire or something of that sort. Reasonably well-informed people will not agree with every single idea in the book. And I did not agree with every single idea that Mearsheimer and Walt presented us. But that did not discredit the book in any significant way. All I have to say is, yeah, I think it's a very important book, and I'm glad it was written. And I disagree with 1, 2, 3, and 4. But I overwhelmingly endorse the fact that they have taken the subject on.
We're going to take a brief musical break to give our listeners another chance to listen to Marcel Khalife. But we're going to be back with our guest, Milton Viorst, in just a few moments. So please stick around and have a listen to this. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Marcel Khalife on the oud. The oud is the Middle Eastern lute. It's a beautiful, beautiful instrument. This coming Sunday, October 28th at 7:30 p.m., Marcel Khalife, the UNESCO Artist for Peace, will be playing at the Aladdin Theater. Marcel's music has been called artistically revolutionary. He's been called the cultural icon and master of the oud.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. You're listening to One Land, Many Voices, KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge, and naturally also available as streaming audio on KBOO's website at www.kboo.org. And we are talking this morning. We're very fortunate to have as our guest Milton Viorst. He's a reporter and scholar. He's written on the Middle East since the 1960s. He's a former Middle East correspondent for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and many other publications. We're talking about the Israel lobby. And, Hala, you have the next question?
Actually, I want to let Mr. Viorst know that he's such a popular guest that we have many callers. If I can let the callers know to please be patient. continue to hold. And if you can please ask your question and be as concise as you can be so we can take as many callers as possible. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Yes, you're on.
Hey. Let's see. I've tried quite a few times before to go from this angle. I haven't read this book. I think most of these books miss the point. The point being that we, the U.S. taxpayer, are funding all of this stuff. The Israel lobby is only as strong as it is because we have the incredible willingness to give as much money and weapons as we possibly can to the Zionists.
Do you have a question for our guest, caller?
Well, I'd like to be able to discuss the importance of the money that we funnel to this very small country and, you know, the diplomatic cover we give it and, you know, discuss how important it is in relevance to this, you know, alleged that the Israel lobby does not control U.S. policy. The Zionists cannot do anything that our government does not want them to do.
Let me interrupt you, caller, because I think you're doing Mearsheimer and Wald a disservice by saying they missed the point, because they talk a great deal about the very points that you raise, and they are extremely important points, and I'm glad you have brought them to our attention. There is a lot of money that is funneled to Israel, but I think that by emphasizing just the money, which is sort of picayune compared to what we're throwing down the drain in Iraq, for example, is the level of policy support that that the right wing in Israel gets from the American government, and that money is only a small factor in that. I mean, I think we're dealing with something that has other considerations in mind, mainly because there is an interesting disposition in American society, which is not rejected by, but certainly not totally shared in Europe and elsewhere, to support Israel's sometimes very extreme positions. And I've been, as your two hosts have pointed out, I've been working in this field for a very long time, and I'm not completely sure myself why we are so disposed. And I think it has something to do with the fact that we are perhaps, maybe it has something to do with the fact that we are a more Christian nation than any other nation in the world at this point. And maybe there is something in our Christianity, not just among evangelicals for whom this is a clear ideological position, but others who feel what? A certain amount of guilt about the Holocaust, about centuries of anti-Semitism, what have you. Fact is that the Israel lobby benefits from a strong predisposition on the part of the American public, and it has its consequences, it has its outcome in American foreign policy.
Mr. Viorst, I'd like to return, if we could, to one of the areas of disagreement that you focus on in your essay. We've grazed a little bit this morning, but I'd like kind of to drill down on this because I think it is a pretty fundamental concern, certainly for our listeners and I think the broader American public. You mentioned that the amount of money the United States is spending in Iraq dwarfs the amount that's sent to Israel, at the billions that are going into this war. But a major part of Mearsheimer and Walt's book is attributing the United States going to war to the role of the Israel lobby. And I wonder, if we want to try to understand the wellsprings of U.S. foreign policy, what are the factors that are going into formulating U.S. foreign policy, something you've studied for a long time, and how do we try to assess the relative contribution of each of these different factors, including the Israel lobby?
Well, I don't think you can assess, and that's an interesting one. Word with any kind of accuracy, because it probably has a different ratio in every single American, whether he's in politics or just like that gentleman who was on the telephone a moment ago, simply a very interested observer. But the fact is, of course, there are many factors that brought us into the war, and certainly we can't ignore oil, which is right up there on top. we can't ignore the fact that with the Cold War over and the United States emerging as the single superpower in the world, we had kind of a free ride to do whatever we want. And you get somebody with the psyche of George Bush who likes the thought, in my judgment in any case, of the exercise of American power. He thinks America has the answers to all questions, which, alas, it does not. And so he would take the fact that there is no rival superpower at this point as an open door to pursuing the areas that he's interested in. I think we have a psychic problem also with George Bush and his father. He wanted to outdo his father. I don't want to get Freudian about this because this is not my area, but I think this is an element. All of these things play into the decision-making process. Somehow, the neocons came into this. The neocons seem to be pushing George Bush and the American people generally into an assertion of power. That's what the neocons want to do. The Israel lobby is a factor. I don't think I'm not making any effort whatever to dismiss its importance. It was a player in the mixture of ideas and notions and incentives that brought us into this dumb war in Iraq in the 21st century. But I don't think, but I think that Walt and Mearsheimer make a mistake in saying that, and I think this is sort of the way they put it, which is, without the Israel lobby, we would not have gone to war in Iraq. I don't think that's true. I think George Bush, for a lot of other reasons, wanted to make this war, and he had Cheney, and he had Rumsfeld, and he had a lot of other guys around there who seemed to think that this was the chance for America to assert its power, and they did.
I want to follow up on this. I think this is a very key question for understanding U.S. foreign policy, and it's something you've written about actually at the time of the first Gulf War in the early 90s. Walt and Mearsheimer really discount the role of oil, and they emphasize the fact that the oil companies have often opposed, for example, they opposed the first Gulf War, and they opposed this war as well. You write about the fact that it's not simply trading in oil that's at issue, but control of oil, and even more than that, in the early 90s you wrote about it was control and reliability of where the petrodollars were being invested. Could you talk a little bit about these different elements of concern that the United States has in terms of formulating its policy towards the Middle East?
Well, I think Walt and Mearsheimer are just mistaken in saying that the oil companies, in saying that oil was not much of a factor, because even if the oil companies don't represent this position, that doesn't mean anything. They will make their profits no matter what happens. I think if we give George Bush and his crowd the benefit of the doubt, by which I mean, you know, if there was any preparation which George Bush had for becoming president of the United States, it was that he knew something about oil and he had a sense of oil. His father was in the oil business. He was in the oil business. And with this notion of what constitutes national security, and with this free ride that we were getting because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, suddenly this was an element. Now, I also probably have cited, as many have cited before, that it was also important that the beneficiaries of oil wealth, that is the oil producing nations, were investing their money in American bonds, which enable us to go around doing dumb things like waging war in Iraq and getting somebody else to pay for it, because those bonds, which ultimately are American debts, but not debts that we have to pay immediately. So we get away with this. You know, we get kind of a free ride on waging our wars. So again, I say all of these elements are important, and I think they were brought together by the Bush administration.
It's time to take another call. Go ahead, caller.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Yeah, I was at the
speech of Walt and Mearsheimer, I guess it was yesterday, at the Hilton Hotel. And a rabbi got up, and he was quite concerned that Walt and Mearsheimer are sort of demonizing the Israeli lobby and said that they call it a conspiracy. And, of course, Mearsheimer said, no, we're not saying that. We're just saying they're an effective lobby. But then the rabbi said, well, your complaint should really be addressed to the spineless politicians that get moved around by this lobby and that. And if the he said, don't demonize us, or if I'm part of a Jewish lobby, that we're just doing our job.
Well, you know, there is a considerable amount of truth to that. We have 435 members of the House of Representatives and 100 senators. And, you know, I've been around, I've been in Washington a long time, and I occasionally meet senators socially. And I remember one of them saying to me once, you know, nobody else comes to me and asks me to do this, but the Israeli lobby comes in and they say, hey, Senator, we've got this letter here, and we really would like you to sign it. And, you know, nobody comes along and says, hey, Senator, you're making a big mistake because the Palestinians, alas, don't have any kind of a lobby. And Islam and the Arabs generally aren't very good at politicizing their causes. Maybe one day they will, but they're not very good right now. And so the senator said to me, well, listen, you know, I sign it. That's in large measure the way Washington works. There is a response, and when you say we have a lot of spineless politicians out there, you're right.
Mr. Viorst, may I address that a little bit and have a dialogue with you about what has happened to those politicians who have stood up to the Israel lobby?
I know what happened to them. A lot of them have gotten knocked off. Yeah, it's terrible.
And so we're talking about what has been referred to
as... And it's still happening. I mean, I know of instances, as you do, that of politicians, some of them pretty admirable, who have said some important things and then get attacked by the Israel lobby, or as in my case, for example, I was on a television program on NPR, and I made some criticisms, and the next morning the producer said to me, hey, we never got so many emails in the history of this program. Well, that's very flattering, but they weren't emails that congratulated me. On the contrary, they said, how can you have this terrible man on your program? And I was never invited back again. So I know how the process works.
Let's take our next caller. Go ahead, caller.
Is that me?
That is you.
Yeah, let's see. I had one question. You know, if I recall, we had this big brouhaha about Arab Emirates a company getting security of U.S. ports or getting control of U.S. ports, managing them a couple of years ago, I guess. And I'd like to ask your caller what his take is on a number of Israeli firms now getting contracts to do U.S. security. I'm talking about Elbit, Magal, G4S, Global Security. Is he familiar with this?
Well, I read about it, as you have, and I certainly followed the Abu Dhabi question of the American ports. Yeah, and I guess my answer to that is I am a little uncomfortable with these groups, whoever they are, outside the control of the United States government, and I put it another way, outside the control of the democratic process, who have so much impact, whether it be Blackwater in Iraq or the Israeli groups that you mentioned, or even these Abu Dhabi groups. I mean, I think these are things that Americans should do. Now, if you think this is isolationist or whatever, I guess I have to say so be it. But the fact is, I think that particularly in these high security aspects, we ought to take care of them. We ought to take care of themselves. I don't think we ought to put them out on the free market simply because George Bush thinks there is a great virtue in the free market in running global affairs. I think there are other considerations involved.
We're speaking with Milton Viorst, scholar and journalist on the Middle East for well over 40 years now. We're talking about the Israel lobby. Milton Viorst, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about another theory that is often cited. It's the strategic asset theory or explanation of U.S. foreign policy towards the Middle East. Your recent book talks about Arab nationalism as a force in the Middle East. And in particular, I think Noam Chomsky has argued that one of the main services, strategic services, that the government of Israel has provided for the United States is essentially smashing Arab nationalism. This is independent Arab nationalism, such as Nasser in Egypt, and as well as when Black September in Jordan, the Israelis prevented the Syrians from intervening on behalf of the Palestinians. Do you think this is, first of all, could you talk about this theory, and do you think it's a reasonable way of understanding at least a part of what drives U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I think you have to let Noam Chomsky speak for himself. I would just as soon not get involved with that, but I think that in this area, for example, in the defeat of Nasser, Israel defeated Nasser in the Six-Day War, but that was in very large measure Nasser's doing, and I think that it's very important to note that Nasser was basically destroyed in the Cold War because John Foster Dulles, who was our Secretary of State, persuaded our government, in this case President Eisenhower, but I think the chief inspiration behind the Cold War policy of the United States in the Middle East was the fact that John Foster Dulles was continuing to think of himself as a crusader. Now, this last book that I have written argues that much of what's going on in the Middle East right now is the new chapters being added to a 1400-year war between Christianity and Islam. Now, these wars are not inevitable, but I think that John Foster Dulles and much of our Cold War policy in the Middle East was generated by this kind of vision. We really could not stand the notion that a powerful Islamic country, that a powerful country should emerge in the Islamic world, particularly among the Arabs, and we were determined to destroy Nasser, and we were determined to destroy Saddam Hussein, and now we're determined to destroy Iran. So I think I see things, you know, I'm basically trained as a historian, and that's tends to be the way my mind works. I think if we understand some of these phenomenon within the historical context, we would understand them a lot better than merely seeing conspiracies here or this or that. The fact is, I would argue that there has been this 1400-year conflict between these two civilizations, and I think that it's still going on. And I think it's something that we really have to understand in order to understand. And Arab nationalism is an outgrowth of that. Western nationalism, European nationalism, was a phenomenon which passed its way into the Arab world after Napoleon, and particularly after the fall of the Ottoman Empire. So, you know, I would argue that if we understood our history in a way that George Bush did not, we probably wouldn't have been in Iraq in the first place. And if we were there, we would be there under totally different terms.
Mr. Viorst, as we watch the Israeli government expanding settlements, carrying out targeted killings, imposing a crushing embargo on Gaza, and now threatening to cut off fuel for electricity to Gaza's population, with the U.S. essentially backing these policies without question, does it surprise you or surprise anyone that Americans are finally becoming aware of these crimes and searching for an explanation for what is clearly an aberration in U.S. foreign policy?
Why do you say it's an aberration, Hala? It's something we've been doing for a very long time.
An aberration in the sense that...
Are you suggesting that the principal drive of American foreign policy is kind of moral rectitude, and this is an aberration from it? Come on. I don't think I would buy that. But, I think what we're doing in supporting the Israelis on the in the instances you have cited is very unfortunate, and I would not call it a moral aberration. I would call it a strategic blunder. There are moral considerations involved, and I admire the fact that you put those higher on your list, maybe than I do, but I think we're just not serving our own interests by doing it in this way, and that's what Walt and Mearsheimer are saying. They don't talk about morality, and I think morality is, you know, something that ought to be talked about, but it's not a major consideration in foreign policy, and probably never has been since the beginning of time. But the fact is that I think we are making a profound strategic error in the course that we are following, and what's equally important is I think the Israelis are making a profound strategic error in the course they are following.
Well, we're coming to the end of our hour with Milton Viorst, and we do apologize for those callers who have not gotten through. As always, at the end of our program, we want to invite all of our listeners to join us next month. We're One Land, Many Voices every fourth Friday at 9 a.m. here on KBOO. And I want to mention as well that there is this very important documentary, Real Bad Arabs, How Hollywood Vilifies a People, showing Saturday, November 3rd at 1:30 p.m. at Hollywood Theater. I want to allow our guests, actually, why don't you mention Marcel Khalife one more time, and then we'll allow our guests some closing remarks.
I'll do that. And just to say that the newly established Arab American Cultural Center of Oregon is co-sponsoring with the Middle East Study Center at PSU Marcel Khalife's concert. He will be here this Sunday at the Aladdin Theater at 7:30. You may obtain tickets through the Aladdin Theater, Ticketmaster, or by calling 503-295-1940.
And Milton Viorst, do you have the last word? Any closing comments for our listeners?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your inviting me, and I appreciate your listening to me. I hope I have thrown a little bit of light on this, but the main thing I, as a journalist and a historian, I am deeply committed to open debate, and I think your program is serving that purpose, and Mearsheimer and Wald are serving that purpose, whether or not you agree with them. I am proud that I have made some small contribution to it myself.
And thank you so much for joining us today, Mr. Viorst, and we hope to hear from you sometime in the future.
Thank you.
And again, you've been listening to One Land, Many Voices with me, Will Seaman, and...
Hala Goris.
That's right, and we are here every fourth Friday of each month, 9 a.m., here on KBOO 90.7 FM, here in Portland. And we'd like to invite you to check our past programs, and if you want to steer a friend towards listening to this program, you can listen to it again at www.pdxjustice.org. And thank you so much for tuning in.